I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, we're going to check in around the country as even the smallest states in tomorrow's primaries believe they can be king or queen makers. But first, to the economy and more negative news today. A report from the United States Commerce Department shows construction spending plummeted 1.7% in January. That's the largest decline in 14 years. And the Institute for Supply Management says fallout from the housing and credit crunch pushed U.S. manufacturing to its weakest level in 5 years last month. This as oil prices hold about $100 a barrel or above $100 a barrel, and the dollar hits new lows against the yen and the euro. So Nariman Berevech is chief economist for Global Insight. Nariman, put these two new reports into context for us, because there's been a drumbeat of negative reports. What is either different or the same about these?
Well, the different part is that housing and construction is even worse than we thought. We knew it was going to contract, but it contracted more. And I think we're still a long way from bottom. We think we'll hit bottom on housing probably the end of this year. Manufacturing is also hurting, although it's a bit of a mixed picture. Things like autos aren't doing very well. On the other hand, any industry that's focused on exports is actually doing very well, because the dollar's weak and the rest of the world is growing at a reasonable rate. So it's a bit of a mixed picture when you just look at manufacturing.
Right. We've reported on that, how companies here who can sell overseas or even move overseas and do their work there are actually doing better. Well, the Commerce Department report says construction spending is down not just for home construction, but also for state and local government projects, highway projects, hotels, motels. Now, we've heard that local governments are being hit by ripple waves from the subprime crisis. Is this that or something different?
No, I think it's pretty much that, in the sense that the reduced spending by state and local governments reflects certainly lower, for example, lower housing, real estate taxes. It reflects the fact that they're hurting, some of them, because they're getting hit by the subprime crisis, in the sense that they're paying higher interest rates now, or getting squeezed by their the lenders who give them money in the financial market. So I think it is the ripple effects, the wider ripple effects, I should say, from the subprime crisis.
What about consumers? Now, President Bush, you know, it's been much spoken of here on the program. After his press conference last week, he seemed shocked that there was speculation that gas prices might eventually top $4 a gallon. How close is the U.S. to a $4 a gallon gas?
I think our view is we'll certainly see $3.50. Whether we see $4, I think maybe a little sort of stretching it, but definitely they're going up between now and, say, the early summer, which is the beginning of the driving season. It's not so much that car drivers aren't pulling back, or that inventories aren't still pretty good. It's just the pricings are getting pushed up by record high oil prices.
Well, you know, you say it's a stretch, but what would it mean? I mean, if there were $4 a gallon gas, would that be considered a tipping point?
I think it probably would be, in the sense that many households, especially at the lower end of the income spectrum, are getting hurt very badly by these high gasoline and oil prices. But $4 is serious stuff, and I think you're talking mega sort of adjustments by consumers, really cutting back drastically on discretionary spending of all kinds. Anything they can put off, they will.
Well, and how does the falling dollar fit into this picture, just to close it out? It hit another low against the euro, a three-year low against the yen today. And as you said, you know, this is, you know, good news for people who want to sell overseas. But, you know, how is it also bringing prices up?
Well, it is a double-edged sword, as you're saying, and it does push up imported goods prices. So anything that's imported is starting to cost more, already is, but will cost even more. And that includes oil, but it includes, you know, anything from toys to clothing and so forth. So it's going to put an additional pinch on households.
And just briefly, you're in contact with people all over the world. What are other people saying about the U.S. economy?
Well, they're very worried, because up until recently, the U.S. was probably the major engine of growth. And as it falters, their worry is that it'll start to affect them as well, especially their exports to us.
Nariman Berevech, Chief Economist for Global Insight. Nariman, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Well, today we want to take a snapshot of the four states participating in tomorrow's crucial presidential primaries: Texas, Vermont, Ohio, and Rhode Island. Democrats and Republicans will go to the polls in all four states. The question for the Democrats is this the beginning of, or the end of a campaign? On the Republican side, McCain is expected to win in all four states, but the question there, how many Christian conservatives will vote for Mike Huckabee? These contests, as we said, are widely seen as make or break for candidate Hillary Clinton, and yet she made very light of that on Saturday Night Live this past weekend. Let's listen.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, well, thank you for coming. I love your outfit.
Well, I love your outfit,
thank you.
Do want the earrings back.
Oh, okay.
do I really laugh like that?
Oh, exactly.
That's candidate Hillary Clinton with Amy Poehler, who plays the candidate on Saturday Night Live and was dressed exactly like her this past Saturday. Hillary Clinton also asking her at one point, how are you? Amy responded, I'm fine, how are you? And Hillary Clinton saying, what have you heard? Paul Berker is senior executive editor at Texas Monthly. Paul, these appearances on the late night talk shows, the ads, a lot of the extracurricular stuff in the campaign, is that having an impact now, or have people made up their minds?
I think most people have made up their minds. In Texas, we had a record early vote, and so it may well be that half or more of the votes have already taken place, that there'll be more votes cast early than in the actual election day itself.
And just explain that for us, because the Texas primary process is different.
Oh, yes, it's really weird. Well, there is a primary, and it takes place. There are actually 31 separate elections in the state senatorial districts. That's how many state senators we have. And the better the Democratic candidate does in that senatorial district in the most recent elections for governor and for president, the more delegates that district has. So the problem, for example, for Senator Clinton is that that the Latino districts don't always vote very heavily because many of their people, for example, are not citizens or underage, and so they don't get as many delegates as the districts where Senator Obama does very well, which are black inner city districts and white liberal districts.
Right.
So that's a problem for Senator Clinton.
Right. But is it a problem for her in general that Barack Obama has been cutting into what was thought to be Hillary Clinton's assured vote, the Hispanic vote?
That's right. He's getting about a third or more of the vote, and it's coming from young Hispanics, upwardly mobile professionals. The Hispanic vote has been trending a little toward the Republican. The immigration issue has completely undercut that movement now.
Well, I apologize, by the way, Paul. Someone's trying to reach you, so we'll just bear with your call interrupt on your phone line there. The Democratic Party is said to be on the rebound in the state of Texas. On the Republican side, John McCain, the presumptive nominee, but we understand Republicans are watching Texas very closely to see how well he does with the conservative vote.
I think he's going to do pretty well today. I think the last thing I saw was it was like McCain was at 56% and Huckabee was down in the 30s. Huckabee is trying to continue to be a presence, but he has no realistic opportunity to win the Texas primary.
Overall, what are people concerned about? What is it they say, they're making their decision based on? What are the issues that hit them?
I think the feeling here in Texas is change. The economy is doing all right. Nobody's particularly worried about that, although there are a lot of foreclosures in Texas. When oil prices are up, it's generally pretty good for Texas. So it's not an economic issue. Senator Clinton's experience doesn't seem to be resonating. That's what she's tried to do with the commander-in-chief ad, the red telephone ad. But I don't think it's going to resonate because the the feeling here is so strong for change.
Well, and yet it's still a close race, but we understand there's another element in Texas we just want to touch on that certainly party leaders will be looking for in the general election, that Republicans are lining up to vote for a Democrat. And I think they're calling themselves Obamacans, voting for Barack Obama.
There is some of that, and I've talked to people in the Republican hierarchy, and this really divides into two types of people. One of them, the Republicans believe, are people who have been voting in the Republican primary because it's the only one that really counts in Texas right now, because the Democrats have been in such distress here. But they're really Democrats,
yeah.
And now that it's a time to have real Democrats, they're back. And the other is the Obamacrats that you mentioned.
Yeah. Paul Burke at Texas Monthly, we know it's going to be a big turnout tomorrow, a lot of excitement in Texas. Thanks for giving us a check-in.
You bet. Bye.
And from Texas, we want to turn to Vermont. 23 proportionally divided delegates up for grabs on the Democratic race. 17 delegates in the winner-take-all Republican primary. Candace Page is a senior reporter for the Burlington Free Press. And Candace, you know, not a lot of delegates, especially compared to Texas. But what is the feeling in Vermont about voting?
Well, there's more excitement here this year than I think ever before in a presidential primary in Vermont, because we usually vote on town meeting day in early March, and usually the outcome is already known by March 4th.
And you remind us, tomorrow is town meeting day in Vermont as well. Tell the people listening nationally, what does that mean, and what might it mean for the race?
It's a day, the first Tuesday after the first Monday in March, when you go to your town hall along with your neighbors, and you get to vote on who's going to be on your town council, and you vote up or down on your town and school budget.
So a lot of people will be coming out for town meeting, and it might increase the already high expected number of people coming out to vote in the presidential primary. What are the big issues? What are the presidential primary issues for people in Vermont?
I think the number one issue here has been the Iraq War. Vermont is a state that per capita, by some calculations anyway, has lost more soldiers than any other state. So while both campaigns have run very generic campaigns here, the advertising they've done, the automated phone calls they've made, have touched on the same issues they've touched on across the country. I think if there was a single issue that explains the enthusiasm here for Obama, particular, it is the Iraq War.
On the other hand, I'm reading in your paper a woman who says, I have a son in Iraq and I don't trust Barack Obama to bring him home alive. So, obviously there's other thinking as well. But just want to ask you about the Republican side. You know, any energy in the race?
Very little. Because, of course, McCain is the presumptive nominee. He has always been popular in Vermont. In the year 2000, he beat George Bush in the primary handily. And both Huckabee and Ron Paul are on the ballot here. They're both polling at about 10%. So, you know, Vermont is a state where you can choose your ballot. You can choose to vote in either the Democratic or Republican primary. It doesn't depend on what party you belong to. And the thinking is this year that the many independents here will gravitate toward the Democratic primary just because it's more fun to vote in a race where your vote might have some meaning.
Well, Candace Page, senior reporter for the Burlington Free Press, have fun tomorrow on both town meeting and primary day in Vermont.
Thanks, Robin.
And when we come back, we're going to keep going cross-country. We'll check in on the races shaping up in Ohio and Rhode Island. And later, do you know a family struggling with a crisis? Have you volunteered to bring over a casserole? What if you could sign up online to help them out? We'll take a look at the website eHope. That's later. And we're back with our update of the four states holding tomorrow's crucial presidential primaries. We spoke with people from Texas, where they have almost 200 delegates for Democrats, 140 for Republican. We touched down in Vermont as well. Next up, Ohio. 141 delegates for the taking on the Democratic side, 88 on the Republican. It was a state that was crucial in the 2004 presidential race as well. Joining us, Bill Cohen, a reporter for the Ohio State House News and Ohio Public Radio. And Bill, we're reading, on the front page of the New York Times, a story that might be uncomfortable for the Clinton camp about how this is going to boil down to grassroots efforts, and maybe Obama has more of that. But this is after millions spent on, ads and everything, that it's coming down to retail politics. So first of all, what are you seeing on the ground? How are voters feeling?
Well, I think anger is probably not the right word, but frustration, I think, is the right word. Ohio is in an economic mess right now. We've got about a 5.5% unemployment rate. more than 200,000 jobs lost in the last 8 years. We're one of the worst-hit states when it comes to home foreclosures. We've got a state budget shortfall right now estimated at between $700 million and $1.9 billion. So there are spending cutbacks from state government, and hundreds of state employees are being laid off. So people are frustrated.
Well, and a lot of people are attributing the loss of jobs and the bad economy to outsourcing of jobs, and that brings up the topic of NAFTA. Both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have expressed displeasure with NAFTA currently, but as we know, she got very upset about his flyer accusing her of supporting NAFTA. How is that NAFTA issue resonating?
Well, I think that the main place it's resonating is in labor unions. They've been the most vocal critics of NAFTA over the years, and we've seen the last 3 weeks, we saw several labor unions who used to be, I think, either on the Edwards bandwagon or perhaps they were neutral, I don't know, but they have come over to the Obama camp recently, the Boilermakers, the Service Employees International, Food and Commercial Workers Union, and the Teamsters. Coming over to Obama, this is fascinating. The Teamsters, I could swear that they endorsed Ronald Reagan 20 years ago, and now here they are for Barack Obama. And I think a lot of those endorsements from the unions is because Hillary Clinton is identified as an early supporter of NAFTA.
Well, let's move to the vote counting, because we know there have been problems in the past in Ohio. So state officials feeling, you know, the media glare this time around.
Yes, and Ohio's top elections official, Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner, she had a panel of experts, and about 3 months ago they declared that the touchscreen voting machines that about 57 of the 88 counties use, they said that these could be hacked and rigged with a magnet and a handheld computer device. So there hasn't been time really to make a main change in these machines. So what they're doing is they're saying, okay, in all these counties, in most of these counties, use your touchscreen voting machines. But if voters are suspicious and they request a paper ballot, then, hey, elections officials, you give them a paper ballot, and we'll do an optical scan on those to count the paper ballots.
Hmm. A quick touch on the Republican side. Again, John McCain, the presumptive nominee, but we just heard Republicans are going to be watching Texas very closely to see how much of the conservative vote Mike Huckabee gets there. What about in Ohio?
Well, the latest poll we saw showed McCain with about 53%, Mike Huckabee with 24%. That leaves about 25% undecided, and Huckabee may get a chunk of those. So it looks right now like Huckabee may get 30 to 40% of the vote. Interesting, but it's not going to stop the McCain bandwagon. And it shows that we do have a lot of Christian conservatives in Ohio, and they tend to like Huckabee, but I've been interviewing many of them over the last couple weeks, even at Huckabee rallies, and they say, okay, we like Huckabee better than McCain, but if McCain is the nominee, yes, in November, we will vote for McCain over either of the two Democrats.
Bill Cohen, reporter for the Ohio State House News and Ohio Public Radio, speaking to us from Ohio. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, now we want to turn to the state that apparently the whole nation will be watching tomorrow. All eyes may be on Rhode Island. Rhode Island, as big as a Texas county. Frank Coletta is host of the morning news show on the NBC News affiliate WJAR in Providence. And Frank, just 21 delegates on the Democratic side in Rhode Island. It's sort of like Vermont in that way. We heard in Vermont tons of excitement, people getting absentee ballots. It sounds as if tiny Rhode Island is also stepping to the plate tomorrow.
The interest is very intense, Robin. The race on the Democrat side is so close that there's really genuine interest here, such that we've seen all of the candidates and many of their spouses make personal appearances in the state in the last couple of weeks, and that very rarely happens.
Sure. What are the big issues? What do people in Rhode Island want to hear about?
Many of the issues are the same as they are around the country in terms of the economy and the health insurance issue, but I've got to tell you, some of the voters here are boning up on all the issues in detail. But and this is either a good or a bad thing, depending on your perspective, but a lot of the debate is being driven by the campaign ads.
You may be seeing ads there in Rhode Island that people in the rest of the country aren't seeing. What are the issues in the ads?
the Barack Obama ad that comes to mind is the one where he talks about how someone, after giving 20, 30 years to a company, gets thrown out on the street with no pension and no health insurance. The Hillary Clinton ad stresses her experience. It's the generic kinds of discussion without getting into real specifics about the cost of the health insurance program or any of the other costs associated with any of the Obama proposals.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what are you hearing? Are people undecided going into Tuesday, and on the Democratic side, of course?
The race is narrowing. Last week, one of the other TV stations in Rhode Island did a poll which had Hillary Clinton 9 points ahead of Barack Obama. But just this past weekend, Brown University released another poll where there is only 5 points between them, 5 percentage points. Hillary Clinton with 42% and 37% for Barack Obama. So the race is getting closer and closer with each passing day.
And, you know, it's not just that the race is so tight and so tiny Rhode Island sees itself, you know, flashed with the results with Texas and Ohio. But if, in fact, these proportional states divvy up the delegates, do people in Rhode Island think it actually could come down to them?
Yes, and that's why you see the increase in absentee ballots, not to mention our Secretary of State, Ralph Mollis, is predicting a record turnout for this presidential primary.
Frank Coletta, host of the Morning News Show on the NBC affiliate WJAR in Providence, Rhode Island, getting ready for tomorrow's big day there in Rhode Island. Frank, thanks so much.
Nice talking with you, Robin.
Okay, a quick look ahead tomorrow on Here and Now, Your Brain on Politics. We're going to look at how the science of neuromarketing is tracking voter preferences. That's tomorrow, but still ahead today, betting on the presidential horse race. We'll take the odds after the news here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's 10 weeks into the new year. How many resolutions have you broken? Maybe you're not exercising, for instance, as you promised you would. Well, maybe that's because you're not exercising your will muscle. Florida State University psychologist Roy Baumeister and his colleague Kathleen Voss, who teaches at the University of Minnesota, have done research that they say shows willpower is a muscle, which can be built up over time, but also, like a muscle, can be depleted if it's not strengthened or if it's overused. And they both join us now. Dr. Baumeister, welcome.
Thank you.
And Professor Voss, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Dr. Baumeister, I want to start with you. We've heard the phrase exercise self-control, but, you know, it was always a metaphor. Are you saying that it's literal?
I guess I couldn't quite say that it's literally a muscle, but it resembles a muscle, and exercise literally does seem to strengthen it.
We read in a Boston Globe article that this may be hearkening back to Freud's thinking about the mind as something that's more an energy force than something cognitive. Can you explain that?
We first started thinking about energy about 10 or 15 years ago, when we noticed in some experiments that after people exerted self-control, they seemed to get worse at self-control, even on subsequent unrelated tasks, as if some kind of energy had been used up. And so we began to think that exerting self-control is not just a matter of figuring out what you want to do and doing it, but actually exerting some energy and expending some limited resource on this. At least increases your stamina in the sense that you're less likely to run out of it fast.
Dr. Voss, it's going to make perfect sense to people who might find themselves exhausted from trying not to eat a box of donuts. They might feel that energy.
Yeah, I think that's right, that some people recognize that they work so hard at avoiding certain foods or certain people or certain thoughts or certain emotions, and that by the end of the day, they become quite fatigued. Of course, this is when they're the most vulnerable.
And are you both saying, and Dr. Baumeister, take it to you, that when you exhaust yourself trying so hard to not do something, that you'll turn around and have absolutely no self-control in the next three things you do?
And you don't even have to really exert yourself really hard on the first thing. Even just moderate acts of self-control seem enough to deplete the resource so that you can already start noticing the difference.
Well, let's just talk a little bit about how you tested your theory. Dr. Voss, tell me, what were some of the things that you asked people not to react to or not, you know, to exercise their willpower over, and then what happened afterwards?
In a typical experiment, participants come into the lab and they are randomly assigned to do a task that requires self-control or a task that we think doesn't require very much self-control. So for some of the tasks, students or other participants will be watching a film that's emotionally evocative. This film might be disgusting, or it might be very sad, or sometimes very, very funny. And their job is to not show any emotions on their face.
For instance, you had them watch old Robin Williams skits that are almost impossible not to laugh at.
I actually used those when I was at the University of Utah, and they were quite successful. They're very, very funny, and it's difficult not to break into a smile and just sometimes just start laughing. But half of our participants are told that their job is not to show any emotions on their face, and in fact, we do videotape their faces so that we can ensure that they're following the instructions. Other participants are just allowed to watch the film naturally. So then what would happen is, all participants would do a task that we think requires self-control. And the theory is that if people have earlier exerted self-control and then are faced with a second self-control task, they should be less successful at that second task. So the second task often has people do things that are maybe a little boring or tedious. Sometimes they involve overcoming urges. So, for example, we sometimes have people do pages and pages of math problems. And in other experiments, we might have participants hold their arms up to the elbow in freezing cold water, which is a pain tolerance task that makes people need to overcome the urge to grab their hand out of the water and get it back into the warm air.
And the theory, as I'm understanding it, is that you can deplete your willpower by overtaxing it by, I'll look at one of the tasks you had, by being forced to sit in front of a plate of cookies while eating radishes and not eating those cookies. So if that sort of breaks down your willpower muscle, how do you build it up?
The short term, it will recover. It looks like it covers with rest. And actually, ironically, eating something can get some of the glucose back into your system to restore the physical energy that you've used up in the first act of self-control.
But reporter Christopher Shea raises our question in an article he wrote in the Boston Globe. You know, what if glucose is your problem? As he writes, you know, should you quickly grab a donut to avoid grabbing more donuts?
We use the sugar in the laboratory because it works fast and we're trying to measure things in a short time. But for use in your own, you probably want to eat protein or something that will still make glucose so that your system can operate.
Well, and then Professor Voss, are you saying further that you could actually do these little lab tests on your own? You could, we read one example, consciously remove the words like or from your speech. That would build up your willpower and actually later help you not to eat a plate of cookies.
Right. If you practice small, judicious acts of self-control, something that's not terribly taxing but at the same time does present a challenge, things like your posture. You can always be thinking about sitting up straight, be thinking about not crossing your legs at the knees, not saying and like, not swearing.
Well, speaking of speaking and swearing, this has had some serious applications at Northwestern. A psychologist studying race relations found that whites who were racists really expended a lot of energy exercising self-control while interacting with blacks. But almost immediately after, they failed other self-control tests. And that feels, again, like something we may see in life. Someone trying so hard not to say something may then go on and just blurt out something else or grab a donut to compensate for not saying what they were thinking. I mean, this seems to be a serious application of your work, Dr. Baumeister.
Any sort of thing where you have to watch what you say, where you're afraid of giving offense, that requires self-control, and that effort to monitor yourself, that depletes the same resource. Another colleague we have, also at Northwestern, Eli Finkel, studies high-maintenance relationships. Interacting with someone who is very difficult and difficult to please and satisfy drains your resources away, and so afterwards your self-control will be impaired in other respects.
That's Florida State University psychologist Roy Baumeister and his colleague Kathleen Voss. She teaches at the University of Minnesota. Both of them doing research in the will muscle. I want to thank you both for speaking to us about it.
You're welcome. It's been fun.
Thank you.
And just a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live at our website, here-now.org. While there's all sorts of things you can do. You can send us your opinion on things. For past programs, you can click on the archives, listen to those as well. And you can always download a podcast, take us with you when you go. That's here-now.org. Also, a little heads up on some of the stories we're going to be following later this week. We want to ask, why hasn't poverty had a place in the presidential campaign since John Edwards' exit? Also, the other war on terror, the insurgency in the American South in the decade following the Civil War against free slaves and their Republican allies. Did these insurgents effectively overturn most of the gains of the war and keep them at bay for the next 100 years? That's coming up this week as well. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, as you have probably heard, it is the day before what's being called Junior Tuesday, a showdown of primaries and caucuses in Ohio, Texas, Vermont, and Rhode Island. Politicians and pundits will be watching the latest poll numbers, even though, as we saw in the New Hampshire primary, polls can be misleading. Well, how reliable are presidential prediction markets? Justin Wolfers is a business professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. He studies prediction markets. He joins us from a studio at the Wharton School. Professor, tell us, first of all, what is a prediction market?
It's just like betting on a sports team or buying stock in your favorite company, except instead of buying your company, you're buying stock tied to the fortunes of, say, Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. It's all sorts of traders, literally all around the world, who are buying and selling, say, a stock that pays a dollar if Barack Obama wins the Democratic nomination.
But, Professor, what's to stop someone from, let's say, the Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton campaign, from buying a lot of stock, you know, making a lot of bets on their candidate to sort of inflate their candidate's worth, to make it look as if more people are buying the stock?
Yeah, the threat of market manipulation. We've actually seen a couple of attempts to do that. And what's really amazing is how robust the markets are to these attempts. Say you tried to bid up the price of Hillary Clinton's stock and you kept bidding it higher and higher and higher. If I'm someone who's interested in making money and you're willing to pay me an outrageous price for that stock, I'd be willing to sell to you. And it's the fact that there's so many people who are motivated by profits who'll then take the other side of those positions that tends to force the price back down to a more realistic assessment.
So where are we with all three of the leading candidates right now, the two on the Democratic side, John McCain on the Republican? For instance, Hillary Clinton, what would I pay for, you know, a dollar if she wins?
A dollar bill if she wins currently costs you 15 cents, suggesting the market thinks she's a 15% chance of winning.
Ooh, that's not even up there with the polls.
It's a very different number than the polls. This is the assessment of the probability she wins. The polls are normally telling us what percentage of the vote she's expected to win. So, for instance, if someone's expected to win 45% of the vote, they may still only be a 15 or 20% chance of winning.
All right. And Barack Obama?
Barack is an 85% chance to become the nominee.
How often are prediction markets correct? I mean, we know that the polls weren't correct in New Hampshire, but were the prediction markets?
When a prediction market says something's an 80% chance of happening, it should happen 8 times out of 10. Equally, it should not happen 2 times out of 10. So if you look at what happened in New Hampshire, the market said that Hillary was only a 7% chance to win in New Hampshire. Well, 7% chances should happen approximately 7 out of every 100 times. So they certainly didn't expect it, but it was certainly in the realm of possibility.
And that's a long way of saying that the prediction markets were wrong in New Hampshire, that Hillary Clinton won.
That's your language, Robin. I really do take probabilities as probabilities.
Well,
and so, again, it's still very possible. There's a 1 in 5 chance that Hillary will end up being, or 1 in 6 chance that Hillary will end up being the Democratic nominee. You could think about this another way. What the market price is doing is it's giving you an assessment of our uncertainty about a particular forecast.
And we should touch on John McCain. Is that just, you know, is it worth betting on that if there's such a presumption that he's going to be the nominee?
McCain's currently a 95% chance of winning the nomination. It's hard to see anything going wrong there. Interestingly enough, Huckabee is not even the second candidate in the betting. Rudy Giuliani is. Interestingly enough, this is something very few people realize, that there's been betting on U.S. presidential elections probably for the last couple of hundred years. In fact, prediction markets on politics predates polling. What's really fun is you go back and if you read the front page of the New York Times 100 years ago, as they covered the presidential race, they weren't talking about who was up and down in the market in the polls, but who was up or down in the prediction markets.
Justin Wolfer is a University of Pennsylvania business professor speaking to us from the Wharton School of Business at the university about prediction markets, including websites like intrade.com. For more on those, you can go to our website, here-now.org. And by the way, have you indulged? Are you a betting man?
I track it too closely, and because I write about these markets, I prefer not to be writing about my own bets. I want to see what the wisdom of crowds really has to say.
Professor, thank you.
It's a pleasure, Robin.
And coming up, eHope. It's an online support group for people in health crisis. It's a way for their friends or complete strangers to click on and lend a helping hand. We'll have that for you in 1 minute, here and now. Care for the chronically ill comes in many forms. Doctors and nurses provide it in the hospital. Hospice workers extend that care into the home. But what about the care needed when doctors, nurses, and hospice workers have themselves gone home? That's when friends, family, and neighbors step in. But sometimes they offer too much help. Too many tuna casseroles, too many time-consuming phone calls. Other times, there's no help at all. Community caregiving is reminiscent of days gone by, but as Here Now's Keisha Simister explains, one organization in Westbrook, Maine, is helping to provide care with a modern twist on the Internet.
I feel like I'm not a good member of society because I can no longer do things or make things.
That's 66-year-old Doug Uranek, a former shipyard worker from South Portland, Maine, several months after he was diagnosed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, better known as Lou Gehrig's disease, a terminal illness that paralyzes the body but spares the mind and the senses. So, as some say, you have a front-row seat to your own demise. Before the disease atrophied his body, Doug spent his days crafting things. He was a welder, a gardener, a potter, and his garage was full of tools.
I sell some of my tools and I give some away, and some I'll save for my son. But a lot of the stuff I don't need anymore, and it will just go.
But Doug found a new tool to replace the ones that he had to let go, a computer that put him in touch with eHope, a nonprofit organization that helps people with terminal illnesses stay engaged with their communities.
I suppose I could go into a nursing home and, you know, be taken care of in these last months of my life perfectly adequately, but I wouldn't have nearly the contact and enriched life that I feel like I'm not a good member of society because I can no longer do things or make things.
That's 66-year-old Doug Uranek, a former shipyard worker from South Portland, Maine, several months after he was diagnosed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, better known as Lou Gehrig's disease, a terminal illness that paralyzes the body but spares the mind and the senses. So, as some say, you have a front-row seat to your own demise. Before the disease atrophied his body, Doug spent his days crafting things. He was a welder, a gardener, a potter, and his garage was full of tools.
I sell some of my tools and I give some away, and some I'll save for my son. But a lot of the stuff I don't need anymore, and it will just go.
But Doug found a new tool to replace the ones that he had to let go, a computer that put him in touch with eHope, a nonprofit organization that helps people with terminal illnesses stay engaged with their communities.
I suppose I could go into a nursing home and, you know, be taken care of in these last months of my life perfectly adequately, but I wouldn't have nearly the contact and enriched life that I do now.
Okay, so here's our website.
Doug's wife, Joan, explains how eHope helped make Doug's last days as fulfilling as possible for both of them.
You have a list, peeps. Those are the people in your group.
There were about 30 peeps in Doug and Joan's eHope group, and each week one of them would call to find out what the couple needed.
someone to read to Doug, someone to make chocolate chip cookies for these the volunteer Quaker group that came over. We have this ongoing project of the renovating the front porch.
The group is made up of family, friends, co-workers, and sometimes complete strangers. They make dinner, wash Doug's hair, mow the lawn, and give full-time caregivers like Joan a bit of a break.
And I don't have to get overwhelmed by phone calls. Things are taken care of sort of outside of me. So then I can really be much more focused on Doug and our relationship and this time that we have together.
On one afternoon, Camilla Whitehead, a friend of Doug's and an eHope volunteer, cleaned the Uranics driveway. Camilla says eHope let her help without being obtrusive.
So you can just look online and you don't have to call, and it's a way to share information that is that maybe used to get done at the marketplace. And given that we all don't meet at a market square, then we can catch up on how the night went for Doug and Joan in this way and figure out how we respond. eHope is a tool, just like the wheelchair.
That's what eHope's founder, Jeffrey Wood, intended it to be, a tool. Wood used to volunteer at the Maine Medical Center, but he was frustrated with the gaps he saw in the medical and hospice system.
If you're a hospice volunteer, you're going to visit a home, and you're leaving, maybe coming back next week, wondering who's coming in behind me. And that many times is overwhelming. With an ALS family, I remember leaving my early cases thinking to myself, I've taken a teaspoon of sand off the beach. And that kind of gave impetus to say, how do you get a bunch of volunteers? And they don't have to come from an agency. They're here. They're in the neighborhood.
A web designer by trade, Wood left the technology business and founded eHope in 2005. So far, about 40 support groups have started up in Maine. Wood says that the first thing he asks a new client is, how well do you know your neighbors?
And over and over and over again, the resonating theme is, I don't know them, or I have a lot of people that go, oh, my neighbors don't like me.
The Uranics had a lot of friends in their neighborhood, so for them, eHope was a streamlining tool. But for others, eHope builds a community from scratch.
I am not really friends with my neighbors.
Lori Williams also had Lou Gehrig's disease. It robbed her of speech, but she could tap a finger onto a device that translated her words electronically.
I would be happy to die today. I have lost so much that made my life. But since I have to wait my body out, I do whatever gives me joy. Things like my nature and my music and flowers and birds.
Before she got in touch with eHope, Lori didn't know a soul in Brunswick. So Jeffrey Wood visited a nearby church, introduced his organization, told them about Lori, and 30 volunteers, including Edith Smith, signed up.
If I knew there was a need and they were perfect strangers to me, I probably would be a little hesitant to knock on the door and say, well, I'm Edith, I'll do anything you want me to do. You know, people are kind of wary of strangers. So eHope really gives us that basis where we can work together.
Volunteers built Lori a ramp so she could wheel in and out of her mobile home. They picked up her mail, drove her to the doctor's, and took her trash out until her sister Jody moved in and took over most of the chores. Jody is far from her own home and family, so she relies on the eHope volunteers for emotional support.
A lot of them have been through this. They've lost people that they loved. They've cared for them. They can help me to see things in a different perspective and never to feel ashamed for my feelings or never to be afraid to express them, to cry, which I've done a lot.
When Jody's sister Lori died at home in October, her eHope discussion board filled with condolences. Doug Uranic also died at home that same month. A few weeks later, his family and friends crowded into a church on a Saturday afternoon to share stories, memories, and sing Doug's favorite song.
I've found my thrill. On Blueberry Hill.
After Doug died, Joan didn't want anything to do with eHope. But then, Jeffrey Wood convinced her to speak with volunteers organizing to help a new patient with Lou Gehrig's.
And it felt really great to go back and to become a part of somebody else's group and to give back to eHope that had, you know, really given to us so much.
Joan says eHope was a lifesaver. Doug was well taken care of, and she got the break she needed. And she says something else happened.
The Quakers didn't know the Buddhists. The Buddhists didn't know the neighbors. The neighbors didn't know the family. And with people coming and going, it's like everyone sort of got connected into the community. It was really quite phenomenal.
Doug and Joan used eHope to build a community much larger than the two of them. Even though the disease robbed Doug of the use of his hands, he was able, even in his final days, to create something. Something that may outlast his backyard garden, his pottery, even his metalwork.
Here now is Keisha Simister in Westbrook, Maine. For more on eHope and online helping, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston, and we want to send a warm welcome today to our new listeners in WHRV HD2 Radio in Norfolk, Virginia, who are hearing us very clearly. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.